Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to another episode of Care in Action. Today, in honor of World Humanitarian Day, we are looking at the reality of aid in a changing world. Joining us as a guest today is Gareth Bryth-Jones, Executive Secretary of the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response. With over 25 years of experience, including many years with CARE, Gareth is a leading expert on humanitarian policy, accountability, and emergency response on the first lines. A warm welcome to CARE in Action, Gareth.
My pleasure.
I have the honor to represent CARE globally on this steering committee, and that's how we have a standing working relationship in this function, and this is why we do this podcast today together. So let's jump right into the topic. You are a real expert and also seeing the changes in the so-called humanitarian system. This is what we are talking about today. It's about emergency aid. And you really have a lot of insight from the inside, and this for a long time. So what is your impression of what we see now? Because now we see a so-called humanitarian reset. We see a real shift. This is much more than a decrease in funding, right? We are now seeing a structural shift. What's your view on that, Gary?
Yeah, so since 2024 at least, and possibly a couple of years before that. And the reason I say that is a lot of my work for SCHR is around understanding, analysing the politics behind humanitarian action. And the political incentives in both donor and affected states have been kind of shifting for some time. Media is a particularly important medium to watch, and it's been quite interesting to see the outlets like The Guardian, The New York Times, that traditionally have been quite sympathetic to humanitarian issues, have really reduced their reporting because they couldn't afford, expensive foreign correspondence. They couldn't afford to cover humanitarian context in such detail. And that feeds through to political and public awareness. I also think one of the long-term challenges here is how do we re-engage the public? I think that's eminently doable. Supporters in the global north, they travel more, they know people from these contexts, quite often they're diaspora themselves. And let's remember as well that virtually everyone cares about this stuff. When we ask anyone, even many right-wing politicians in my own country, the UK, even Nigel Farage, the right-wing political leader, is famously has said that, yes, of course we should help starving people, of course we should help those in need. So, that's I think what drives it. You mentioned I'm not keen on the reset. One reason for that is I think that what's really going to impact affected people is what happens inside organisations, not what happens in that interagency space. And you and I have talked about this before. And what's interesting is we have very little visibility on what's happening inside organisations, and particularly the big organisations, the big large NGOs like SCHR members, like the UN agencies. And that's really worrying me at the moment about how we move it. And then what's really changed in the last year and a half has been how brutal and incompetent so much of the shifts have been. We've seen very, very abrupt ending of programs. None of that is about improving humanitarian response. It's hugely inefficient. It's hugely wasteful and brings huge unnecessary harm to affected people. So that's the one bit that really caught us by surprise. Sitting on the SCHR, that we've been talking about kind of cuts coming this year, cuts coming last year for a while, but they were much more brutal and much more incompetently handled than we'd expected.
Would you say that it all started with the dismantling of USAID?
No. So as I was saying, I think we knew that there was problems coming. When you look at the political incentives, look at the media coverage, it was foreseeable that we would have these challenges. And many other donors have kind of hidden behind what's happened in the US. And what's interesting is that voters in the global north who pay for so much of this stuff, this isn't what they wanted. And very clearly, we had, even in May 2025, after Elon Musk had shared all his lies about how corrupt the foreign aid was, even then, still 83% of Americans, when polled, said they supported foreign aid. So this isn't parties doing what their people want in the global north. This is very much driven by a particular political agenda. And we can see that political agenda coming over the last 10 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And what is also an interesting phenomena, and we have also talked about all this before, is that people assume that there is much more money spent for international aid than it is in real fact. And they think it is much, much more. So if we would have that level of spending that people in Europe, the civil society assumes, then our problem would be smaller, I would say.
Exactly. And there was just as recently as April this year that the French did a barometer of G7 voters. And G7 voters thought that their governments were spending 19% of their annual budget on foreign aid. And even then, 67% of those voters thought that foreign aid should either stay the same or grow. So if they'd had explained to them by their leaders that actually it was 0.7% of their government spending and less than 0.3% of their gross national income, it's quite clear that there would still be very, very high levels of public support for continuing that aid.
But before we take a deeper dive into the topic, let's spend a moment on SCHR, because the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response were eight of the largest northern-based international organizations come together. And it's not open records, it's also not a mystery and not a secret. And you said yourself, we don't know enough what is ongoing in the large stakeholders and aid providers at the moment in the situation that we are in. So I wouldn't call it compete for the same donors, but we work with the same donors, the same media, everything. So being the general secretary of such a diverse group, because half of us are faith-based and half of us are not like CARE. So, and we can all name them. It's CARE, it helped me, it's Oxfam, it saved the children, it's the International Committee of the Red Cross. And on the faith-based side, we have CRS, the Lutherans Act.
Act Alliance, that's right.
Act Alliance and World Vision. So how can one be the general secretary of such a diverse group, and how can one come to conclusions and useful insights? How do we do that from your perspective, where you sit?
Well, I think actually they agree on a huge amount. So we're all committed to humanitarian principles. We're all, as we heard at our meeting last week, very committed to maintaining quality professional levels of aid. I think where the differences are is around approach. So some members like Oxfam are more open for kind of public advocacy, whereas others prefer that, you know, ICRC, maybe World Vision prefer behind the scenes work, more focus on the delivery on the ground. But I think we're rock solid on the need for quality assistance. We're rock solid on the need to apply humanitarian principles. And also, because most of our organizations are quite old, we have a certain level of institutional knowledge around the lessons that we learned in the 1980s and the 1990s. And one of the things is this determination that we see in our organization to avoid going back to that kind of poor quality truck and chuck, we call it, because a truck drives up and you just chuck the stuff out of the back. That kind of old style assistance that really ignores the dignity and the agency of affected people. And I think one of the things that we're seeing with this crisis at the moment is an extra urgency into those discussions about the best way to reach people, to respond, to support people. And the challenge we have is that there really isn't one right answer. It's often context specific. So an example at the moment is the balance between in-kind food or cash or health service, running health services, and also between what affected people ask us for, which is often it's livelihoods, it's education, it's often peace and protection, which is often outside of our power to deliver. And then also what donors want to pay for. So they're really pushing us at the moment, saying we want life-saving stuff. We want stuff like food and water that we can see, that we can point to, and we can say, hey, we paid for that. So that's a huge, huge challenge. And then one of the things I'm often asked is why, if we all agree, that we all just merge into one organization. And I think it's a bit of a weird way of thinking, because in our wider economies, we're very clear why it wouldn't be a good thing to just have one provider of food or one provider of cars. And for us, we've been very clear throughout the last 2 years about the need that we need to have what we've been talking about as an ecosystem approach, where you have lots of different actors working in an interrelated way, but independently. That spreads risks. It enables organizations to develop technical specialities, to foster innovation, and also support diverse channels through which affected people can access aid without having single points of failure that leave that delivery really, really vulnerable.
I think it's also a rather naive question to ask. As you said, you never would think of having only one provider of cars or whatever we need in our daily life, so for furniture or whatever. And I think it also has to do a lot with how we look at things and how others do. But I would say we have more in common than one would assume from the outside, because the better you know the colleagues from other large organizations, the more common ground you find. And what is also a truth that we have been working together where it made sense, and we will work even more together in the future. And Care and Safe, we have already an example. We are testing this Impact Alliance in our country offices. It's more based in country offices, where we join forces on things that we can find common ground on easily. And I think that's a very good idea. And it's also a model that is open to others for joining. So I would say that SCHR also provides a wonderful platform to explore what we can do, not only better, but what we can do in the future, and really to understand each other better. Because in the end, we are working all for the same people, and those are people in need. And I think you said something very remarkable, what the people that we are working for want. And this should be in the focus of everything we are doing, and also everything that donors are doing. Of course, I know that this is a rather naive wish and approach, but we should really listen firsthand to those who are affected and purely life-saving. And this is something that our audience also might maybe hear for the first time. Purely life-saving is simply not enough. We need all the protection topics, like Care is working for women and girls. So we need to make sure that people are safe in the approaches that we are taking. And we also know from other organizations that education is a part of survival. You can't nourish people for years and years.
And I also think what's really important is that people need to have a sense of hope that things can get better. And that's why we consistently hear people who are hungry, who are thirsty, saying, no, we want you to prioritize livelihoods. We want you to prioritize education for our kids' future. And that's a very human thing, right? And I think that's where we as a system have got much better to. That's why we focused on protection in the 1990s, because people told us they wanted to feel safe. It's why we focused on education and emergencies in the last two decades, because that's what people told us was really important. And it's not just people, it's also their governments, it's also their communities. So it really builds up from that level of the individual affected person.
And that's what we all are advocating for, and what is also one of the key advocacy messages from SCHR, right? That these things have to be kept as part of our work, not because we as NGOs are wishing that, but the people and the governments that we are supporting are asking for that.
Yeah, it's about quality aid, it's about dignity, and it's about hope, and recognizing that people are human beings, they're not just mouths to feed.
And I have never met anybody, and this is maybe in contradiction to some narratives that we hear from some of our politicians, I have never met anybody in 30 years who was happy to sit in a refugee camp and who was happy to receiving aid for years. I've never met anybody. Did you?
No. And it's interesting. One of the questions I've always asked people, both in my time working as a frontline country director, but also on my visit since I moved to these global roles, and I always ask them, where do they see the future? And you know, no one ever sees the future being displaced. And often they're much more dynamic than we give them credit for. People don't necessarily want to stay in their villages. They want their kids to go into cities to get professional jobs, to build their lives. You know, often there'll be someone who'll want to stay on the land, but people are aspirational, just like people everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Like people everywhere, that's the buzzword. So let's talk a little bit what sort of crisis we are in. I think this is also a bit of an academic discussion, because it depends where you sit in the whole system. I would say, yes, we have a funding crisis, absolutely. And I would also say, yeah, it might be also a legitimacy crisis, because if we can't fulfill what people are asking for, then we all will get in trouble. So some even assume that we have lost sort of confidence. I'm reluctant to highlight that, but some people might lose confidence if we see more unwillingness to support humanitarian aid also on an intergovernmental level, right?
So I'm smiling a lot because this is a question that very much presses my buttons. it's something this issue about legitimacy is very dominant in the discussions within the humanitarian sector and within academia. But I don't think it's really stood up by the evidence. So our colleagues at the Federation of the Red Cross recently did some research on this, their Community Trust Index. And just this week, I heard a briefing on that. They found very high levels of trust from affected communities. So across 15 countries, including some really, really tough ones, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, they scored 8.15 on a scale of 1 to 10. And where there were lower scales, for example, in Nepal, it was among people who hadn't received services from them. Mm. And so, and it also reflected some known issues in that country program. So in that case, it wasn't so much a lack of trust, more it was a lack of communications and transparency. And even the Edelman Trust Barometer, which is being quoted quite a bit recently, because it said that NGOs were trusted less than business. But what's missed often when people quote that is that the question was framed, it was, if I could trust an institution, if it was led by someone who differs from me in the values or background that they have. And I would struggle to trust someone who was running an NGO who didn't share my humanitarian values. So it's not surprising. What I think it tells us is that people expect non-governmental organizations, non-profits, to be driven by values more than they expect businesses mm-hmm. to be. And then it's also, and we've been talking a bit about this within SCHR, it's important to consider what we're being trusted to do. Are we being trusted to solve the problems in Gaza? Probably not. It's not within our power. That's not something you should be trusting humanitarians to do. Are we trusted to deliver life-saving services? Absolutely. And quite often we're trusted to deliver those services a lot more than others. For example, the member states who have the ultimate responsibility to do that. Are we trusted to solve the full range of community issues facing a community? Again, probably not. But I think we are trusted to deliver the things that we can do, that we specialize in, where we can deliver it to a high mm-hmm. quality. And I think a key issue there is about being honest with affected communities about what we can and can't do. And this is, you know, what we call in the jargon participation. We want affected people mm-hmm. to participate in decisions involving the assistance they receive. And there's a really concrete example recently. Save the Children has taken over coordinating shelter in Darfur at the moment. Now, that's not something that Save the Children would normally do, but they're doing it because there's no one else there who is better equipped to do it. And I think quite often this is something that we need to look at as humanitarians, be suitably humble about what's within our power, be honest with affected people about what we can do and what we can't do, and then say, is the solution we can offer better than the other solutions available? And usually it's the case, and, you know, for example, with Save in Darfur, I'm sure they'll step aside if there's a shelter agency that can get access and be present in that space to do that work. And we've talked a lot about that complementarity in recent months.
And many actions are born out of the necessity to do something on the ground and not necessarily born out of the aspirations of any organization to now start working in shelter, like CARE is working, for instance, in shelter and WASH. But we will not stick to these patterns always because we simply are not equipped any longer that all of us are doing the things that they have done in the last 20 years.
Exactly. But then I think this is where that legitimacy framing is problematic because it risks becoming self-fulfilling. You know, quite often, you know, we discuss that in good faith, but often we've seen, particularly in the US, but also in the politics here in Europe, that it's not in good faith. It's people who deliberately want to undermine trust in institutions because that suits their political and other objectives. And I think we need to be realistic about that and really be clear about you know, where the issue is with humanitarians and where it's about those wider political and economic challenges, where actually it's the politics that has to change. It's those other elements that have to change. And we need to be suitably modest about our power to change them. Our power isn't zero, but it's not absolute. And, you know, quite often those things
are, for sure, in many cases, overrated. And I think that's why we think so much about legitimacy and trust and all these things as organizations, because that's the, if you want, that's the currency that we live on. And we don't want to lose that trust for the people, neither with the donors and nor with the people that we are serving with the funding that we all raise. Now, and this is why we are so timid about it. And I think we should be more honest also internally to say clearly, we need more clarity what we can do and what we cannot do. And you mentioned yourself the crisis in Gaza. And this is something that is heavily debated in all our organizations, as we heard last week. And we have to be very clear that we have to stick to the humanitarian mandate, that we are deeply rooted in international humanitarian law, and that we are certainly not able, no matter how much we wish, that we could serve this large humanitarian problem.
Exactly. And then one other thing to note as we come up to World Humanitarian Day is that's also what keeps humanitarians safe, is that it's that acceptance by communities, it's that recognition of our principled approaches that enables us to negotiate with armed groups. I started my career negotiating with the Revolutionary United Front, the RUF, in Sierra Leone. And the reason they were speaking to us was because they knew that we came without a political agenda and they valued what we were bringing to the communities that they were nominally in charge of. And so I think that's what one of the things that keeps our humanitarians safe and our colleagues on the front line as safe as we can in these really difficult times.
Yeah, because this is also relatively spoken, because it was never as dangerous as it is now to work as a frontline worker. And we have so many colleagues that really lose their lives in helping others. So that safety for humanitarian workers and safe access, I would say these are the main topics that we all constantly advocate for, because this enables us to deliver what we are here for.
Absolutely.
So let's spend a moment on local partners, because this is also something that we, not only in SEHR, but there are many, many ways of looking, what is local partnership, how it should look like, what it is. You might have heard, as our appreciated listeners, about the grand bargain. I'm not sure if you've heard about it, but in a nutshell, it is about 25% of what we spend in international aid and emergency aid should be implemented through local partners, not because we want to do it like this, but because local partners are the first responders on the ground anyhow. This is, in very rare cases, it is an international organization. It's always the local people, and they know best what they should do. And as a matter of fact, we have reached, I have the actual figure from 25 here, 8.7%. And this target is even decreasing. So there's a little bit of, not a little bit, there's a bit of frustration and also disappointment around. I would say that CARE is quite progressive when it comes to working with local partners, and we always have been. And nowadays it is also an economic necessity to even work more with local partners. So what is your take on that from your SCHR perspective?
Yeah, so a couple of things on this. And I was at the World Humanitarian Summit back in 2016 when we made this commitment. I think one of the things that was interesting, the discussion at the World Humanitarian Summit when this was quite a radical position, I think those of us who were pushing it were thinking about what would make aid more responsive to affected people, what would make it more cost-effective, and things like that. What we didn't think about at the time was the power dynamics, the political and social realities, the mechanics of how we mobilize resources and transfer them around the world to assist those in need. And I think that's a part of the discussion that continues to trail behind. I think, secondly, we've not done as much as we could have done. And there are reasons for this. Some are good, some are less good. And they almost all relate to those issues of kind of power dynamics, trust, relationships. And listening to one of your earlier episodes with the European Commissioner, who was talking about the challenges that they have had on funding local actors directly. I think one thing we need to be really clear on is that there's going to be countervailing pressures on localization in the coming months. On the one hand, local actors will probably get less direct funding than they've got till now. So donors are cutting the staff. They need to build trust and manage grants and to empower local actors. So I think intermediaries will become even more important than they have in the past. This is not something you'll hear much in the discourse either. And I think it sets us up for cynicism and frustration. And so I think it will be really difficult to get to those generally much smaller local organisations the level of funding that they really need to deliver. And then on the other hand, there's going to be, because we're losing so much capacity, SCHR members alone laid off over 15,000 staff last year. So there will be less international presence in the communities where those local actors are working. So they will have more space and more opportunity to show what they can do, but they'll have a lot less resources to do it. So that's going to be a tense situation. I think we need to be honest about the realities of that, manage expectations, work with our partners. And where we are intermediaries, as several of the SCHR members are, they take money from a donor and then they deliver the work through local partners. We need to work to be the best intermediaries we can, recognizing that maybe it would be better for that funding to go directly to them, but recognizing that that's practically going to be extremely challenging over the next few years.
And especially for large institutional donors like the EU, the humanitarian exactly. Part of the EU funding is ECHO. And you were referring to a previous podcast episode with Commissioner Popovsky, who said that we have to, as the contract signer, we have to be European for European tax money. And we have to be held accountable for what happens to the total sum of the contract. But of course, they want us to deliver through local partners minimum 25%. And they are reaching quite good numbers at the EU level. But I would say, as a European taxpayer, somehow understandable. On the other side, it might be in the future a good idea to recalibrate also this point of view and to really build new alliances and also new working methods with different local partners. I think also we as large organizations, we have to be brave and bold and also develop new ways of cooperating and working together. Even if we had good ways in the last 5 to 10 years, I think we should be open for much more than we were in the past, at least for care. I would say there is still room for improvement.
Exactly. And it's not just Europe, but just thinking about, you know, in places like Canada and the US, where it's much easier for politicians to go out in a more nationalistic world and say, we're channeling your money through trusted organizations from our country. And again, this is where I come back to the political dynamics behind humanitarian aid. We need to understand those so that we can rise above it and deliver the principled humanitarian aid that we all aspire to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And many of our member organizations in SCHR are working under UN mandate, so CARE including, many others too. I would like to spend a moment on the representation that SCHR is also having at the so-called, now it gets very technical, Interagency Standing Committee of the United Nations, which was founded by the General Assembly and still is in existence. It was in the 50s, if I remember correctly. So it's long standing.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. It was actually set up in the 1990s, particularly after the Balkan Wars. And so OCHA and a lot of these structures come from that period. SCHR is actually much older. SCHR is 50 years old and substantially, along with a lot of the NGO coordination bodies, substantially predates the ISC. But the ISC was the effort of the United Nations to say, actually, we want this to be more coordinated and more organized. So they established those roles in the 1990s.
So then you see how capable our General Secretary is. Then even I mixed it up and I was quite sure that I was very prepared for this podcast. But thanks for sharing the correct date with us. But still, it is 30 to 40 years old and this is long pending. Yes. So can you frame in a few words what SCHI is doing at this Interagency Standing Committee level?
Yes, so the Interagency Standing Committee, so that's the heads of the UN agencies and people like yourself and I who represent for the various NGO coordinations. The Red Cross is also represented there. So we have the leaders of those agencies, and the idea is that's a high-level kind of coordination. And then we have subsidiary bodies. We have the Emergency Directors Group, and we have what's now called the Humanitarian Working Group. The Humanitarian Working Group works on the policy side, and the emergency directors on the operational side. And because we have a very lean secretariat in SCHR, I sit on all of those bodies my sins. And so I've had a very insider seat in how those dynamics work, where those bodies can be extremely effective, and where, particularly from a frontline perspective, they can be quite frustrating and seem a little bit removed from the day-to-day realities of delivering assistance that affected people can access.
So one could say that we are connecting somehow all the levels of emergency aid, right? From the frontline worker, from our partner organizations, up to the highest committee level of the UN.
And one of the things it does is it ties together those different mandates on, for example, health from the World Health Organization, children and water and sanitation on UNICEF, and it brings together those broad range of both faith-based and secular NGOs who then work with local partners across the world. So it's really why we talk about an ecosystem, because a lot of some of those structures are directly connected, but many of them kind of orbit around each other, and making sure they're doing their work in a complementary way is really, really important.
So I think I'm one of the shortest serving members on this committee. I only started this year, but I think it is really beneficial, not only for myself and for CARE International, but also for all the other organizations to hear and learn from each other and to better coordinate all the different realities of emergency aid, which are not existing because we wanted to diversify the approaches, but because they are needed in real life. And exactly. People perceive things very differently. And I think the richness of these perceptions also could lead us and help us navigate through these difficult times that we are facing. And I think we have managed that our members are the large international, predominantly called Northern organizations. And I think that, and this is maybe also because each of us thinks that we will survive this crisis somehow. And I think this is also quite probable because we have many donor relationships, we have brand recognition, institutional resilience, and these are all things that smaller organizations, and in particular some of the smaller local organizations, they don't have it to that extent. Is that something that we can balance, or is that something we have to live with?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question because many people said to me, you know, when we first had the city, the very brutal cuts that were very short-term and poorly planned, they said, oh, you know, SCHR members will be fine because they're big organisations. Actually, that's not true, because when you're a large organisation, it means, yes, you have lots of money coming in, but you also have lots going out. You have huge programmes, you have huge responsibilities to staff, to partners, to affected people themselves. And so one of our members calculated in February 2025 that delaying a decision on staffing by a day would cost them between $1 million and $1.5 million because of the unfunded staff cuts, staff costs that they had when the US very abruptly withdrew its funding. So that meant that they had to change very, very quickly. Now, fortunately, some of our organizations had started planning those changes beforehand, so we're able to accelerate existing plans. But it means that, yes, big organizations do have advantages. They have access, they have power, they have existing relations. They have the people to manage those relations and keep them oiled and working. But it also means that, and I do think we'll lose some big organizations. I think one of the things I'm worried about is that we'll lose key institutions, particularly with some of the UN agencies who have specific mandates. We need to be very thoughtful that and try and be, you know, it's like a guided descent. We're falling, but hopefully we can have a parachute that avoids the spikes and rocks as we go in for a landing at that lower level. So I think that's really something that we're trying to manage at that strategic level at the Interagency Standing Committee over the coming months and years.
And I have also the impression from my own organization that some people think the worst is over. And I'm always saying I fear that maybe the worst disruptive moment might be over, but I think the impact and the decrease is not over yet. We will see it next year and in 2028 massively. Would you agree to that?
Yes, absolutely. And I am worried that there's a bit. There's not enough seriousness around the kind of the ongoing nature. One of the challenges is that donors have tried to minimise the damage of their cuts by bringing funding forward, particularly to fill some of the gaps that the US very abruptly left. The challenge with that is then that we have empty pipelines going forward. So normally you would have new projects being funded throughout the year. So although we're probably not going to see big abrupt cuts of the likes that we saw in the early part of last year, what we will see is a constant tailing off, closing of programs that donors have been more responsible. They've committed to exiting those programs responsibly, but they'll still be exiting. So you'll see constant kind of layoff of skilled workers. You'll see constant withdrawal of services, and that will get worse and worse over the next 2 or 3 years. And that's a reality that we're having to manage. And of course, the people on the end of those cuts are saying, well, what will I do? I rely on this assistance. You're not giving me this just because it's nice. You're giving me this because I need it. I need it to survive. And we're seeing increasingly, and I think we'll have increasing evidence over the next couple of years of the kind of strategies people are having to adopt to survive, so that they'll have to sell off productive assets. We're already seeing a rise in child marriage. We're also seeing a rise in abuse as people get desperate. So I think those are the kind of things that are really, really worrying. And ultimately, we'll see deaths, possibly on quite a large scale, because this system, this ecosystem is what's been keeping people alive. Hopefully, people will have other coping mechanisms. Generally, they're harmful coping mechanisms that will harm those people, both in the short run, but also in the long run. But that's the reality that's now baked in by the scale and extent of these cuts.
And do you think that the governments of the countries that we are all working in will be held more accountable in the future? Do you think that this wish that many and also many European institutions and governments have, do you think it is realistic, or is it something that we will not see in the next years?
No, I think there's a level of denial, and we see this also on climate change, right? These are things that might happen in the future. And I think that's going to be really, really difficult for us to cope with. We're used to being able to say, for example, during the recent Venezuela earthquake, we heard people say, yes, we'll get you the assistance that you need. And I'm not sure we'll be able to, because we're so overstretched. And we constantly hear this from our frontline colleagues and from affected people themselves, that they don't have those alternative options.
The Ebola response is totally underfunded.
Exactly. And again, these are the things where actually funding these properly would save you money in the long term. And this is where we're seeing those short-term cuts will add up to very, very expensive long-term consequences, both in terms of human suffering, but also in terms of economies, stability, those other elements that the states say that they care about. So this is really a self-defeating strategy that will worsen a lot of the problems that the donors say that they really care about.
So when you talk about the donors, you frame it for institutional donors. Institutional donors are governments, the European Union, the state of Austria, things, institutions. Yeah. If I talk about donors, then I also include private donors, which are very key for all the MCHR members. And if I'm a private donor listening to this podcast, what is your message to private donors? Because they will not close the gap, the enormous gap that institutional donors have left. On the other side, we desperately need their support to sustain a dignified and in human rights-based emergency response. So what would you say, why is it still worth donating for the earthquake in Venezuela, or for the people in Sudan or in Gaza, you name it?
Well, absolutely. And that's the good news, is that individual citizens have really stepped up. They're scared, despite the cost of living crisis that we hear about. The funding from individual givers has held up pretty well. And again, this reflects what people say. People say they want to help people around the world. And so that assistance has held up. I mean, my message to them would be that your giving makes even more of a difference now than it ever has, because quite often that giving is flexible. And we can prioritize getting that to the places that need it. The sad thing is they're not able to respond at the scale, although they can do. We have seen this. I worked in the tsunami response in Indonesia in 2005, where people gave huge, huge sums of money, really put their governments to shame. But I think that's much harder in these complex times and in complex emergencies where there's multiple causes. I think it'll be interesting to see with the Venezuela response. I also worked in the Haiti earthquake response in 2010. And we saw a big outsurging of popular support, of people giving money, taking money from their pockets, from their day-to-day pay packets, and giving it to support those people on the other side of the planet. So that's really heartening and uplifting for me, that funding has held up despite the very real challenges that people are facing in their daily lives.
So this is, and everybody knows that I always want to end on a positive note. This is a clear call to action from our today guest, Gareth Price-Jones, the General Secretary of the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response. Thank you for being our guest. And it is also a clear call to action from CARE International and especially from CARE Austria. All our listeners, please open your mind, open your hearts, and open also your wallet and support emergency aid. People-to-people support is more important than ever. You have heard it not only for the earthquake in Venezuela, but also, and it is really, really key that we stand together, that we execute humanitarian solidarity, and that you strengthen us to deliver principled humanitarian 8, which is really key for people like you and me. I hope you had an interesting hour with us. I hope Gareth, our guest, enjoyed being with us at Care in Action. So I do wish you a very nice week, and I count on you that you listen in again next week when it's again time for another episode of Care in Action. So see you there. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There, you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.